Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
If it's Friday, policing in America once again in the spotlight as Memphis mourns the death of Tyre Nichols and braces for the release of police body camera footage that family members, lawyers, the police chief, the head of the FBI are all calling horrific. Plus, the race to run the Republican National Committee, the latest power struggle inside the GOP, as the conservative party grapples with its future, its identity, and the influence of former President Trump. Plus, the shocking new footage released today showing the moment an assailant broke into Speaker Nancy Pelosi's San Francisco home and brutally attacked her husband with a hammer. How you doing? Welcome to Meet the Press Now. I would say happy Friday, but this is not going to be a happy day. I'm Chuck Todd here in Washington. We're going to begin with the latest out of Memphis as the city and the country brace for the release of body camera footage that's going to show the traffic stop and beating of Tyre Nichols by five now former police officers who have been charged with second degree murder. The video is scheduled to be released to the public at 7 p.m. Eastern tonight. Nichols was 29 years old, an avid skateboarder. He was a father. He worked for FedEx, big part of the Memphis fabric, by the way, and was remembered as a near-perfect son by his mother. On January 7th, police initiated a traffic stop on Nichols. He was subsequently beaten, and he would die in the hospital 3 days later. Details about what actually happened in the incident have been very slow to be disclosed by officials. But here's what we do know at this time. As I mentioned, those five former police officers were charged yesterday with second-degree murder and at least six other assault-related charges, including aggravated kidnapping. All of them are out on bail. We've heard from Memphis Police Chief C.J. Davis that officers violated their training during this interaction with Nichols. They used excessive force, and they did not provide adequate first aid. Davis told my colleague Tom Yamas today that the officers' actions were, quote, outside of humanity.
That's right. Completely next level. Completely outside of, you know, humanity. I'm not even going to say training. I mean humanity. The mindset, you know, and the reason why I think there is an analogy to Rodney King here is that there was this sort of element of groupthink in this instance. No one stepped outside to say, stop.
Nichols's family gave us a grim preview of what to expect from this video, describing the officers beating him with their batons, hitting him, and, quote, kicking him like he was kicking a football. In a press conference today, a lawyer for the Nichols family said that the actions taken by the police amounted to terrorism. Nichols's mother, Rovon Wells, recounted the pain of knowing her son was crying out for her during the beating multiple times.
But for me to find out that my son was calling my name and I was only feet away and did not even hear him, you have no clue how I feel right now. No clue.
Folks, it can't be overstated that every single person who has so far seen this body camera video has described how horrific they found it to be. Words that we've not seen ever used to describe other incidents. It's not just the Nichols family or lawyers, the police chief, the district attorney, and even the director of the FBI this morning.
What happened in Memphis is obviously tragic. I have seen the video myself, and I will tell you, I was appalled. I'm struggling to find a stronger word, but I will just tell you, I was appalled.
As I said, the video will be released this evening. Officials expect it to prompt public protests, but they're hoping to avoid potential unrest during these protests. This afternoon, Nichols's parents once again warned about the contents of the video and pled for any protests to remain peaceful in honor of their son.
I want to say, I've never seen the video, but what I've heard is very horrific, very horrific. And any of you who have children, please don't let them see it.
We want peace. We do not want any type of uproar. We do not want any type of disturbance. We want peaceful protests. That's what the family wants. That's what the community wants.
Joining me now is Antonia Hilton, who's been on the ground in Memphis for the better part of this week. Antonia, all the officers are out on bail. Is that surprising?
To many people in this community, it is incredibly surprising. Black communities in Memphis, but frankly across this country, Chuck, are surprised by the pace of all of this and the consequences that these officers are now facing. They're grateful for them, but in some ways, the pace of all this, the swiftness with which they were first fired, not put on paid administrative leave, but fired, and then the range of the charges, from official misconduct to oppression to aggravated kidnapping to, most importantly, second-degree murder, the main charge that people kept telling me they wanted to see these officers face. It raises questions about why in the past these kinds of investigations, these kinds of consequences have not moved so quickly. The community here and, again, in communities across the country are much more accustomed to begging and pleading. Right. They sometimes wait months to see videos, not a matter of weeks. And so it raises a whole host of questions for people about what the new standard is going to be now. So if this is what officials are able to do, they're going to come out and they're going to talk to reporters like me, like Tom Yamas and everyone else at NBC right. who's been here on the ground, and they're going to be forthcoming with information. Why haven't they done that in the past? And they want to make sure that's what they're going to do in the future. I think we have a clip of a bit of Tom's conversation with the Memphis police chief, Davis, and people have shouted her out. They've been grateful for her transparency, but it also means that's what's going to have to happen going forward, Jeff.
Hey, Antonio, I'm actually playing a much more extended version of that interview after you and I are done with this hit, so we're going to hold off on that clip part because we have a longer version of it. But I was hoping you could tell me a little bit more about the conversations you've had with the family of Tyre Nichols. And frankly, I what you've learned about Tyre, the human being.
You know, Tyre was loved by so many people here. And he was a father. He was a skateboarder. He loved photography and sunsets. A social person, by all accounts, a really kind person who cared a lot about his city and his community. He worked at FedEx. His father also worked at FedEx. His family was kind of in a routine together, and his mother always looked forward to seeing her son and her husband come back from the same job and then spend time together at home. So this has been, you know, heartbreaking, of course, for everybody who knew and loved him, but you know, so many people in Memphis see themselves in Tyre, or they see their sons, their nephews, their cousins in Tyre. I actually happened to be here working on another education-related story here in Memphis days ago and started talking to young kids, I mean, little students who know about what's happened here, who are talking about it in their classrooms right now. And so this is, we haven't seen the video yet, and it's sending those kinds of shockwaves through the community. And of course, across the country. In fact, President Biden called the family not long ago for about 20 minutes, extending his condolences, talking to the mom about how special their son was. And so, you know, I think the hope from the family is that so much of the good that Tyre brought to the world is going to be at the forefront of people's minds. But that's not going to take away from the demands for accountability, the attention onto this police unit, and questions from the officials as, you know, of course, things proceed now.
Well, and frankly, those questions belong in Washington with all the leaders that have stood by talking about doing something but not getting anything done. Clearly, we've said there are institutional and cultural issues in police departments across America. How many more incidents do we need before that is taken up as a federal issue? Antonia Hilton, really appreciate your reporting on the ground there in Memphis. And as you both, as you brought up and as I noted earlier, Tom Yamas had an extensive back and forth with the Memphis police chief. And I want to play a longer excerpt of it here. He began by asking her about the timing of the release of the video for this evening.
We know the response sometimes from videos that have a tendency to incite emotion and even anger. And what we wanted to do was think in terms of, you know, the impact it would have on the community, the impact it would have on business, the impact it would have on rush hour, our school system. So we thought Friday afternoon, Friday evening would be a good time to release it to try to get people home, try to have our children safe, and have a means of being able to manage any type of response.
If I can ask you to go back to the first time you saw that video, if you can describe in one word, what was it like?
Horrific, alarming, disappointing, sad.
How would you describe the energy of the officers that pulled over Tyre Nichols?
On a scale of 1 to 10, they were at a 10.
Is that not police protocol?
No, it's not police protocol. I've been in this business for 36 years, and a lot of the aggression and, you know, the approach was over the top. And I think that's sort of what, you know, we're trying to figure out. That's still ambiguous to us.
From the get-go, then?
Right.
This
what caused that? Yes. From the get-go.
And then it just escalates from there?
It escalates from there.
From the get-go, the protocol wasn't followed.
Right.
Talk to me about what happens next, because the family has described their son being kicked like a football. We have heard comparisons to Rodney King. Mm-hmm. And when you hear attorneys for the family, they talk about just a brutal beatdown.
Absolutely.
Is that all true?
Yes, it is. It is true. And as I said before, it's hurtful. I had an opportunity to speak with the family, and this was right before they viewed the video, and I wanted to let them know ahead of time that this video is going to be hurtful, it's going to be painful for you to see this, and it may not answer your questions. It just may cause you to ask more why.
Did you have to apologize to Tyre Nichols' family? I mean,
you know,
how do you have that conversation?
You naturally say, "I am so sorry," you know, and that wasn't just from a police chief. That was from someone who felt her pain, who felt her loss, and you know, words can be empty sometimes. That's why it was important for me not just to deliver condolences or apologies or "I'm sorry." You know, what I wanted to deliver for this family at least was that first step of justice for them to quickly deal with these officers within the scope of my power and to help facilitate this movement to the DA's office as well. It was obvious to me that what I saw was beyond the scope of what is condoned in this police department and any department that I've ever worked in before, and something that was not a proud moment.
The family's described him as being put up, and then he slumps down again. He's put up. They yell some curse words at him. He slumps again. Did you witness all this? I mean, was Tyre Nichols beaten to a pulp where he was completely unconscious, and then the abuse sort of almost continued afterwards?
Well, you know, and now I'm going with recollection. There were times when he was laying. There were times when he was sat up. There were times when he was mumbling and saying words. But it was obvious that he was not in control of his physical self.
There was no sense of urgency to get this man help.
In my mind, there was not.
You can see more of Tom's interview tonight on Top Story with Tom Yamas. That'll be live from Memphis. I want to bring in Mark Claxton. He's a retired New York NYPD detective and director of the Black Law Enforcement Alliance. Mark, I think what's been remarkable about this story has been we're essentially, the police department has made the decision, let's let the public see the video, then we're going to fill in the details about the traffic stop. Because it's remarkable how little we actually know of what happened. It's almost as if everybody wants to wait, let us see it for ourselves, and then perhaps questions that people may have, including a weapon, no weapon, what was the impetus, all those things. What do you make of how this has been handled so far?
Well, I think it's clear, and even based on the interview you just showed, that Chief Davis has really established and set a clear tone and tenor and has established a particular tempo to this investigation that goes outside of what is normally a police investigation and has proceeded at this point into a prosecutor's investigation. So clearly the decision has been made that based on the egregiousness of whatever evidence, video evidence that everyone has seen and we've heard about, the decision's been made to proceed at a kind of an expedited pace. And they're comfortable with this pace and comfortable that all of the questions that may come as a result of the release of the video have been in some way addressed prior to its release. And they think that is a good strategy moving forward. One, it shows that there is a major openness and honesty and integrity into the process, and they're hoping to instill that in people and also prepare people for the worst before they have to have deeper discussions about what actually is contained in that video evidence.
I think that you sort of alluded to it, and this is which is normally it seems, when I say normally, when we've dealt with these before, there's always some internal investigation before it's handed off to a prosecutor if it's deemed an actual crime is committed here. It doesn't appear to be there was any of that. And as you said, do you think perhaps we've set a new standard that we will no longer see? You know, Chief Davis made a decision to be very public here. Not every chief would do that.
Well, knowing the law enforcement community as well as I know it, I can tell you that traditions and the manner in which they operate and proceed, especially in cases such as this, are going to be resilient and stubborn to change and resistant to change. So I'm sure people are appreciative of this level of openness that we're experiencing. But I think people would be wise not to expect or anticipate that there will be some precedent that the other law enforcement entities and agencies have to adhere to, because that's simply not the case. And that in part is the problem that we face. There is a lack of national standardization in as far as police conduct, training, and even investigating these type of incidents.
Many times these incidents have involved white police officers and African-American victims. This is a case where it's African-American officers and an African-American victim. What does that mean to you? What does that tell you? And what kind of impact do you think that has had on how this investigation has gone?
What it should say to you is that these type of incidents, these kind of police interactions that lead to avoidable or unnecessary fatalities, is much less about color or complexion and much more a result of the severe toxicity that exists in modern day policing. And now let's be clear, racism and race always has an involvement in law enforcement, always has and continues to have significant involvement in law enforcement. But it's important that we identify what causes these deaths, these unnecessary fatalities, these interactions, these avoidable deaths, is toxic police culture, which subsumes all other. It subsumes color, race, ethnicity. It's toxic police culture, which, of course, sometimes can be fed by racism.
I wanted to sort of stay on this topic. These officers were part of something that was called the Scorpion Unit. And the reason it had the name Scorpion, it was an acronym for Street Crimes Operation to Restore Peace in Our Neighborhoods. Just trying to come up with an acronym that uses the word Scorpion doesn't seem to automatically tell me people are interested in peace.
Not necessarily, but I don't think you have to place too much emphasis on the acronym itself. And recognize that these type of units exist in police agencies across the nation under different names and monikers. And oftentimes what happens is if they have an incident that they're trying to run away from, they'll just change the moniker or the acronym for the agency, for the entity within the police department, and continue business as usual. Even recently, much discussion has been about the reinstitution of what's called street crime unit in New York City, for example. And the key part of reinstituting or reconstituting that unit was increasing the level of accountability and dramatically increasing the level of supervision and reporting requirements for those plainclothes units, because they operate quite differently than the men and women in uniform handling day-to-day calls.
Right. Mark Claxton, I appreciate you coming on and sharing your expertise with us. It's very helpful to the conversation. Good to talk
Thanks,
to
Chuck.
You got it. Coming up, the race to run the Republican National Committee. It just wrapped up. I'm going to talk to a Republican congressman about what he thinks it means for his party's future. We're going to talk about some other stuff, too, because he's also calling for a sweeping ban on TikTok, not just government devices. We're talking not downloading at all in America. You're watching Meet the Press now.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.
For more than a decade, Comcast has been committed to bridging the digital divide and connecting millions to affordable, high-speed internet. But the barriers to get connected go well beyond affordability. Through Project Up, Comcast is committing $1 billion to reach millions with digital skills training, resources, and opportunities needed to succeed in a digital world. Project Up, building a future of unlimited possibilities. Learn more at comcast.com/projectup.
Welcome back. Meet the new boss. Same as the old boss. That is the chair of the RNC moments ago. Republicans, members of the Republican National Committee, reelected Ronna McDaniel to another term, leading the party. A challenge from committee member Harmeet Dhillon fell far short on the first ballot. McDaniel's victory comes despite a push for new blood in party leadership from many corners of the party, including Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Joining me now live from the RNC meeting in Orange County is our own Vaughn Hilliard. And Vaughn, this is a case where the conventional wisdom was right. I think the most remarkable thing to me is that that Ronna McDaniel was up against Fox News commentators, Ron DeSantis, Charlie Kirk, you know, the sort of the loudest voices in the activist room, the loudest voices on TV. And that didn't seem to have much of an impact.
No, and that's even after a secret ballot. And that was kind of the question that we had over the last 24 hours, Chuck, was whether there were folks who were quietly full of discontent, unhappy with the fact that the party didn't win the Senate majority. They lost the White House in 2020 and only narrowly won the House, despite in the last cycle raising $400 million and spending $400 million, whether they would then come in with their secret ballots, even after giving a head nod to Ronna McDaniel, and vote for Harmeet Dhillon. What the results show us is that that didn't happen. Ronna McDaniel pulled off about two-thirds of the vote. Harmeet Dhillon pulled off just 51 votes out of 168. And so that's kind of the question that I'm now beginning to pose to some of the folks who are allies of Harmeet Dhillon. You mentioned Charlie Kirk. I asked him right before the vote came out. I said, what if Ronna McDaniel does win? To what extent are you concerned about being embraced by the party that clearly you have been outspoken and pushing back against? And he told me that hopefully they listen to us. And that is kind of the question going forward here, because Harmeet Dhillon was allies with the likes of Carrie Lake, who was here the other night, as her surrogate. I mean, she's been the lawyer for the likes of Project Veritas, right? She's sort of to the right of where even MAGA is at here, but yet, is there questions about fundraising? Some of her allies, there's a conservative radio personality here who was right before the vote came down, said, you know, warned that fundraising would dry up for the RNC if Ronna McDaniel won again, because they asked donors to come and donate big this last go around, and they didn't come up with too much. And so the question is here going forward is there kind of a grassroots part of this party that looks to the outside instead of looking at the party establishment?
Well, in many ways, Vaughn, we have already noticed that, right? Club for Growth is in some ways spent more money in Senate races than the RNC did. You know, we're sort of watching this party fracture on the media front, on the candidate front, and now apparently on the donor front. Anyway, it would be fascinating to follow. Vaughn Hilliard, I'm telling you, there's more stories behind you. Go find them. It'll be fascinating. As always, sir, thank you. Joining me now is Colorado Republican Congressman Ken Buck. I mostly want to talk to you about tech and what you're doing there, but you're a former state party chair. You're an elected Republican. I'm curious, from 30,000 feet, what message is being sent to the party that after a disappointing midterms, Mitch McConnell, Kevin McCarthy, Ronna McDaniel, Donald Trump, the same leadership of the party is essentially still leading the party? Does that give you comfort or concern?
No, it gives me comfort. I think Ronna McDaniel knows her job. I think she is raising a lot of money, and she will continue to raise a lot of money. Her job isn't a policy position, and she will support whoever the Republican presidential nominee is who wins the primaries. She's also responsible for helping state parties. And I can tell you, as the former chair of the Colorado State Party, she did an unbelievably good job of helping us fund Cory Gardner's campaign and President Trump's campaign. We weren't successful either, but it wasn't a lack of effort from the RNC.
Do you think some of these louder voices that were behind the candidacy of Harmeet Dhillon just don't understand how the RNC works?
No, I think there's always going to be in the Republican Party conflict. There's always going to be people who are not satisfied without 100% win. And even if they get 100% win, they're still not going to be satisfied. So it doesn't bother me. To me, it's a healthy political process to have a primary, a healthy political process to have opposition.
One more piece of politics I want to get off. This has to do with House Republicans. Earlier this week, I spoke with Victoria Spartz, your colleague from Indiana. She went on the floor of the House and really sort of condemned the idea of kicking off Ilhan Omar off of committees. That basically, that the tit for tat, she thought two wrongs don't make a right. I'm curious where you are on this. Do you think, this is something that should be done? And do you think the tit for tat is healthy?
I don't. I think that Nancy Pelosi ruined this institution. I think she ruined it in a lot of different ways. And one of the ways was kicking members off of committees, which hadn't been done in the past. Certainly their own party has kicked members off committees. Steve King from Iowa, for example, was removed from committee assignments by Republicans. But that hasn't happened with the other party. She determined who would get on the January 6th commission. And put two Republicans on that committee. So I think that we should not engage in this tit for tat. I am opposed to the removal of Congresswoman Omar from committees. I have a little bit less certainty about Congressman Schiff and Swalwell on intelligence, just because it's a little bit different than a regular committee. But I'm going to think through that and make a decision.
Well, that's a speaker's prerogative. That's not a vote. The one where you have a say is on Ilhan Omar, and you're saying you'll vote against that resolution.
I am saying that I have a loud voice, and whether it is that or others, I will. So when the Democrats appoint someone to the Intelligence Committee, typically the Republican speaker has accepted that.
Right.
To not accept that, I think there has to be a very good explanation.
Let me move to why we originally invited you. We talk about these TikTok bans, and I think a lot of people don't quite understand what they are. The state bans are not bans. People in Oklahoma can still use TikTok. It's people that work use a device that the state government pays for that they can't use TikTok. Explain how your ban, you're calling for a full ban. How do you pull that off?
So originally, Senator Hawley and I wanted to ban devices on government phones. President Trump actually did that by executive order. Now we are introducing legislation that would ban TikTok in this country as long as it's owned by the Communist Chinese Party. We will not tolerate them gathering intelligence on our young people to use in a future cyber war. And so it is really important that we first educate Americans about the dangers of buying this kind of a product from China, and secondly, seek to ban them. Now, I think competition is great, and I think that having TikTok competing with Facebook is exactly what we need in this country. But we want to make sure that it's an American-owned company, or at least that we have some certainty that the data that is created by these users is kept in this country without any access from the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, what you're describing, and I've been down this road with the owners of TikTok, that's what they claim they've created with Oracle, that Oracle is going to own the data. Is that enough, or do you think a full divestment of ByteDance is what's necessary here?
Well, I think there needs to be a separation, but I am happy to attend hearings and learn more about what they claim is happening. There are still information out there that they can seek to remove people from China, giving the order to remove people on TikTok. And so I think there's a danger, and I think it's important for us to hold hearings and pass legislation if necessary.
I don't mean to pick a scab here, but I know you wanted to be the subcommittee chair of the Judiciary Committee having to do with antitrust legislation. There are reports that you're not going to be able to do that. Thomas Massie got that gavel. He's very much a libertarian, which when it comes to antitrust might mean he's total hands off. Does that slow down this idea? Because you did seem to have some conversations with Amy Klobuchar, I think, in the Senate. Like, there's been some bipartisan discussion here. Is this slow it down, or do you think Thomas Massie will pick up this mantle?
No, I think that my good friend, Thomas Massie, will oppose antitrust legislation. He's voted against it in committee in the past, and he is ideologically opposed to the bills that we have introduced. However, it isn't the only way to move forward on this, and we're going to explore all possibilities to make sure that we protect the American people from these big tech companies.
But realistically, this does seem to slow things down, at least on your side of the fence there in the Capitol.
It motivates me more to get out and get members excited about it. So I think it slows it down in one route. It opens it up in some others.
Congressman Ken Buck, Republican from Colorado. I blew it last time. I didn't realize you didn't have Greeley in your district anymore. I keep learning all the new remaps. I got to get re-familiared with the new map there. Anyway, Congressman Buck, thanks for coming on and sharing your perspective with us.
Thank you.
Still ahead. Is the global COVID emergency over? It's a question the World Health Organization is debating today as we approach the 3-year mark of the pandemic. You're watching Meet the Press now. Ronna McDaniel was just extended as RNC chair for another term. She's led the party since 2017. You have got Kevin McCarthy, who is still the leader of the House Republicans. You have Mitch McConnell, who's still leader of the Senate Republicans, the lone Republican presidential candidate. Is also the current frontrunner and former President Donald Trump. And he appears stronger now than he did a month ago. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Well, joining me now, NBC News senior congressional reporter Scott Wong. Simone Sanders Townsend, host of Simone on MSNBC, is here. She's also a former senior advisor to Vice President Harris. And Brendan Buck, a former advisor to Republican speakers Boehner and Ryan. He's also an NBC News contributor. So, Scott, this is one of those, and I know we in some ways weren't surprised by it, but you know, for a party that was so disappointed in how the midterms went, they've made zero changes. None. Not at all.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the lesson here is it's really hard to knock off an incumbent person.
Right.
Secondly, I think these are, inside politics, right? These are inside games. These are about relationships. And those are the things that we can't see. So while we see the results of the election, they didn't win back the Senate. They had a lackluster showing in winning back the House majority, relationships matter. And so I think that is one of the big takeaways here is that Ronna McDaniels was playing the inside game. Mm-hmm. Mitch McConnell knows how to play the inside game perhaps as well as anyone in Washington. Yeah. And Kevin McCarthy, you know, using a bunch of carrots was able to, you know, lure some of those never Kevins back over to his side.
You know, Brendan Buck, it was interesting yesterday, Ron DeSantis very rarely likes to dip his toe into anything that might blow back on him. And he did. But I thought this was sort of a low risk move for him because it sounds like he wants to say, well, I'm not the establishment. Sure. That's you, Donald Trump.
Yeah. He's a contrarian, so I mean, I don't think that's surprising that he did that. Look, we needed to have some type of conversation, and obviously, Dylan is I think a flawed challenger to McDaniel, but at least we needed to have that conversation. So hopefully, this process lit a fire under her. I think Ronnie McDaniel was the better choice of these two, or I guess three people who were running, but at least now she has to confront that there's a lot of people who are unhappy with the leadership that we're doing.
It is funny that the least supposed Trumpy of the three candidates was the one Donald Trump appointed.
Right, exactly.
I mean, you know. You just get...
Well, so she's stuck, right?
Yeah.
And all of them are stuck. Like, it is, and I very much believe
this. By the way, longest-serving chair in history of the Republican Party.
And yet doesn't really know what direction we want to go, because she's stuck in this position of we can't live with Donald Trump and we can't live without Donald Trump. And that's probably the biggest problem that she faced, but also her opponents were facing.
Well, and let's be realistic. Harmeet Dillon was not Lee Zeldin, okay?
Meaning, no.
And I think part of the issue is, and we see it with the DNC too, being the head of the RNC and the DNC ain't what it used to be.
No, it's not. And I think it's very, I mean, look, Jamie Harrison is in a very different position than Ronald McDaniel is, right? Because the president of the United States is currently a Democrat.
Right.
So he does not have as much leeway, if you will.
But how powerful did Tom Perez feel?
Well,
right? And I don't mean that. No disrespect
Perez.
To Tom Perez. It's just the nature of these jobs now, I think.
Well, I think it depends on who is doing the job and how and what kind of relationships, to Scott's point, and influence that they have. I agree with you that the flawed challenger is the best way to describe Dylan's challenge to Ronna McDaniel. But the reality is, I think a lot of people were thinking about, people forget, the party's, their main job, the RNC's main job this cycle is going to be to administer a primary process to choose their presidential candidate. Yeah. That is the job. And you need a chair and officers who understand the job and can get it done.
What I want to know is, does Kevin McCarthy really want to be, it's normally the Speaker of the House, if that's of the party, is chair of the convention? Good luck being chair of this convention. Brendan Buck, I want to ask you a little bit of news there from Ken Buck. No relation, I assume?
No relation.
Okay. Who said he was not going to vote for the resolution to kick off Ilhan Omar off of committee. You know, we're doing our own little whip count here. It sounds like McCarthy didn't have the votes for this.
Yeah, I think what a lot of these members are finding is the things that they demanded from Kevin McCarthy actually doesn't have the support of 218 votes in the House. And maybe they'll be okay with that. But this is not the only example. They talked about bringing up the fair tax, this getting rid of the income tax and replacing it with a sales tax.
I think Hakeem Jeffries would introduce that resolution, fair tax, if you wanted him to, right, Scott?
But they're realizing, you know, the House is not as conservative as they think it is. Not everyone is a Freedom Caucus member. And all these things they want, they're going to figure out. And it comes to the basic stuff of funding the government. They're probably going to realize there aren't the votes for spending cuts that they want.
I was just going to say, Scott, does this give us a hint that maybe this debt ceiling showdown is going to go down with a whimper, that there really isn't, it's a smaller group inside this conference that wants to fight?
It's a smaller group in the House, the Freedom Caucus members, the hardcore conservatives. But with this narrow, narrow majority, those guys do have a tremendous amount of leverage. And so, you know, if they want to shut it down, if they want to, you know, force a debt showdown, they can do it. They have the numbers based on what we know from this past speaker fight.
Yeah. I want to shift gears to Ron Klain versus Jeff Zients. You know them both.
Yes.
Simone. What it looks like to me is one is a super Paul in Ron Klain, who also knew how government worked. Jeff Zients, former budget director, knows everything how government works. But you never thought Jeff Zients wanted to micromanage a presidential campaign. Right?
No, and I don't think he'll be doing that.
And I was
given
just gonna,
everything.
Is that what this is?
I think so. Look, Jeff Zients, very capable manager, right? He knows the numbers. Well liked. I've worked with Jeff, sat through some very interesting meetings with him. Ron Klain is someone that has known the president for a very long time. Just they're two different individuals, but also quite capable. I think Ron will be very missed in this White House. He played a lot of different roles, right? Mm-hmm. Ron Klain is somebody that go out on television. Not only was he tweeting, he was going out on TV. He was he was actively involved in conversations in terms of how things are happening and getting done. Ron was not afraid to make a decision. I think Jeff Zients will be willing to make decisions, but it's very clear to me that the political side of some of the things that are happening as it relates to the president's impending presidential campaign, that will be ceded to, when it comes to the White House, folks like General Mally Dillon, currently Deputy Chief of Staff, and Anita Dunn.
And that's who, it's sort of how David Plouffe, David Axelrod, and was split, I guess, Jack Lew at some point there. Scott, though, how would progressives have reacted if Jeff Zients was chief of staff in the first 2 years versus how they're reacting today?
I'm not sure. I don't know that.
I say that because Ron Klain was sort of a protector of the progressive movement.
Oh, I see.
And Jeff Zients, I think more of a center.
Jeff Zients is seen more as Simone knows too well, you know, more of a manager type figure. And so, yeah, much different than Klain. Klain was very popular with the progressive wing, was in regular contact, had the relationships on Capitol Hill. Zients, I think, not so many relationships on Capitol Hill, but he is a manager, and so he's going to be having a much different focus, and he'll let some of the other folks take on the political stuff.
Given that he's not a tweeter, does that mean maybe he can have sort of conversations with a McCarthy or a McConnell that maybe Klain couldn't?
It gives me a little comfort about the debt limit, which is, I think, the big issue of this year. I mean, he's a bit of a technocrat. I think he probably negotiated some of the previous debt limits that we dealt with. So he's probably someone who I think certainly also cares a lot more about the markets and understands that we need to come to a solution and may not be so concerned about what are progressives going to say if we fold, you know, a little bit over here. He probably just wants to get the job done. I think that's encouraging.
And there's nothing like a former budget director who knows how to help make sure that how the
used to be chair of the NEC as well. He's got a lot of economic experience.
Yes, he does. Simone, Scott, and Brendan, thank you for the time this week. Enjoy the rest of your weekend if you can. After the break, disturbing new footage of the break-in and violent assault against Paul Pelosi. It was released to the public today. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. A San Francisco court today released new audio and video of the attack against former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul, that took place last October. And we're going to warn you, some of what you're about to see is pretty graphic. The new video includes the moment, captured by Capitol Police surveillance cameras, that the assailant, David DuPape, broke into Pelosi's San Francisco home. Also released today is video from police officers responding to the break-in. And that shows the moment that Paul Pelosi was brutally assaulted. Again, some viewers may find what we're about to show you disturbing, so take any precaution that you want to take. Here it is.
Yeah, literally sitting there.
Hi. Hey guys.
How you doing?
How are you?
What's going on, man?
Everything's good.
Hi. Drop the hammer.
Nope.
Hey.
What is going on right now?
I'm not getting an answer on call.
Bro,
Paul Pelosi spent roughly a week in the hospital after the attack and included a surgery to repair a skull fracture. Investigators say DuPape was targeting Nancy Pelosi, who at the time was Speaker of the House. She wasn't at home. He now faces both state and federal charges, including attempted murder and attempted kidnapping. Josh Letterman joins me now from Los Angeles. And Josh, I guess the question is, why 3 months later? Why not see that? I mean, I say this, we're going to see some disturbing video in a few hours of what happened in Memphis. And that was a 3 week, difference, obviously slightly different here, but why the delay?
Well, if it were up to the defense or the prosecutors, Chuck, we probably would never see the video that came out today. In fact, the public defender who is representing David DuPape just put out a statement saying that he thinks it is a terrible mistake to release this video. He thinks that is disrespectful to Mr. Pelosi, and also that it could be prejudicial against his client, David DuPape, in the defense here. But the media organizations, including NBC News, who appealed to the judge to release this information, made the point that this can't be secret only in terms of not showing this to the American people. A lot of this evidence was already played in an open public court hearing. And given some of the controversies and really conspiracy theories that have swirled around this case and assertions that potentially Paul Pelosi had known this individual before or wasn't under duress, all of that should be put to rest by the evidence that came out today, which clearly shows that he was struggling with this intruder for the control of this hammer, as well as the 911 tape that was released, where you can clearly hear that Paul Pelosi tells 911 operators he doesn't know this man who has invaded his home, tells them that this person says he's going to wait for Nancy Pelosi and is clearly trying to signal to 911 that he needs help, even as this intruder is in his home, potentially threatening his life. So a lot more details here, Chuck, that really add to our picture of how this dramatic scene played out.
But once again, because of our distrust of so much of our institutions, this is a case where I think we had to err on the side of transparency. Everybody does these days. If you're going to get trust back, you're going to have to verify things first. Anyway, Josh Letterman, thank you for that report. Coming up, the FDA looks to change the nation's COVID vaccine strategy. But before we go to break, we want to take note that today marks the 78th year since the liberation of Auschwitz in 1945. And in honor of International Holocaust Remembrance Day, the second gentleman, Doug Emhoff, the first Jewish spouse of an American vice president or president, visited the Nazi death camp today, intended a commemoration of its liberation while remembering those who were killed there. You're watching Meet the Press. Welcome back. It has been nearly 3 years since the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a global health emergency. And both global and domestic health agencies are once again debating what the future of the fight against COVID should look like. A WHO emergency committee met behind closed doors in Geneva today to discuss whether to end the COVID global health emergency. But we likely won't hear anything on that decision until next week. Meanwhile, here in the United States, an FDA advisory committee unanimously voted to recommend that the bivalent formula targeting Omicron, currently available as booster shots, be used in all COVID vaccines. The recommendation won't go into effect unless adopted by the FDA. The advisory committee also discussed, but didn't vote on, potential changes to the vaccine schedule. On Monday, the FDA proposed simplifying the vaccination process with annual shots targeting the latest variant of the COVID virus, much like how flu shots work. Joining me now is Dr. Michael Osterholm, director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Michael, it's actually good to talk with you. Normally, it's doomsday scenarios that we're talking about. So I guess the good news is, are you ready to say no pandemic, this is endemic, and this is what life is like now? Is that where we're headed?
Well, it's clear that we're over the pandemic in terms of in people's minds, but don't forget that 550 people died yesterday from COVID in this country. Which, if you compare that to the leading cause of cancer deaths in this country is lung cancer, and that's about 350 deaths a day. This is still extracting a price, but yes, I grant you, it's not at 3,300 deaths a day, but it is still a really significant challenge.
And it does seem as if that the current variant circulate that. Each different variant has at least, you tell me, it does feel as if the severity is less than it has been. Is that due to the changes in variants, or is that due to our ability to, our vaccinations? What do you say?
You know, Chuck, the honest answer is nobody knows. And we have to be very humble at this. Think about the following. While we've had the experience that you just referred to here in the United States, Japan, just as of last 10 days, has had its highest peak of cases at any time in the pandemic. And their death rate actually exceeded anything we ever saw here in the United States during Omicron. They'd had two peaks, one in August, September, and one again just this past few weeks. And they were both caused by a variant, BA5, that we had seen already, this exited the scene here in this country. You know, it's one of those things where it's not a seasonal virus yet. In the last 5 to 10 weeks, the epidemiology of COVID in the parts of Australia are no different than they were in the northeastern part of the United States. So I think we have a lot of unknowns yet. Yeah. We don't know what this is going to do.
Well, speaking of that unknown, when China made the decision to suddenly shift away from zero COVID, when you circulate COVID amongst a billion people, I guess, what kind of variant should we expect? What have you seen so far? And as a researcher, what do you expect to learn from what was essentially, you know, nearly a third of the world on a different COVID schedule than the rest of us?
Well, you know, ironically, it was a year ago today that I co-published an op-ed in the New York Times, basically stating that zero COVID policy would never work in China and that Omicron would ultimately overrun it. surely they were able to stop using their draconian measures of lockdowns with both the Delta and Alpha viruses, but they were not nearly as infectious as was Omicron. So is this not a surprise to see what's happened here? It's a tragedy in some of the darkest days of the pandemic. Will it result in new variants? I don't know that. No one knows. It's clear that the new variants that we've seen over the course of the pandemic, Alpha, which emerged in Europe, Beta and Gamma in South America and South Africa, Delta, which emerged in India, Omicron, which emerged in Africa, all of those occurred where there had not been a lot of immunity before. So you could say there's not a lot of immunity in China that surely could give us a new variant. But at this point, we don't have any evidence of that yet.
I know quite a few, I assume quite a few private institution heads have asked you for advice of what should COVID policy look like. Forget the government policy and all this stuff. If you were advising a business of a couple hundred people, what's a realistic COVID policy when it comes to testing, masking, and physical attendance by workers?
Well, let me just say at the outset, my goal is to see everyone get COVID twice a year in this country, but have it be nothing more than a common cold-like illness. That would be really a victory. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do right now is eliminate severe disease, hospitalizations, and deaths. And clearly, those over age 50 make up the largest group where that occurs. So there, I think getting the bivalent vaccine is really important. The data are clear and compelling that that can reduce the likelihood of serious illness, hospitalizations, and deaths. If you're going to be in public places, wear a, you know, good respiratory protection, N95. And if you do get ill, make sure you get medical care immediately so that you can avail yourself to the antivirals. For many people under age 50, we have to acknowledge that this is a disease that is not likely to cause severe illness at this time, that many people are moving on with their lives and doing what they did before the pandemic. So I think really trying to protect those older people would be what I would tell any workplace right now.
Dr. Earlstone, it's good to get what I call just sort of straightforward advice without worrying about pleasing one constituency or another. It's just straightforward. Good to hear from you.
Thank
good
you.
To see you.
Thanks,
thank
you, Chuck.
And thank you all for being with us this hour. We're going to be back Monday with more Meet the Press Now.
Ready for a new and exciting career challenge? At DHL Supply Chain, you're part of a team committed to creating innovative solutions for some of the biggest brands in the world. We're recognized as a best place to work, where people are valued, supported, and respected. DHL Supply Chain is hiring for a wide range of salaried operational and functional roles. Previous experience in logistics is welcome, but not required. All opportunities, no boundaries. DHL Supply Chain. Apply today at joindhl.com.